Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
We kick off this very special Easter Sunday night on Open House with a very special series of stories that's gone out around Australia this Easter. Forgiven People is a television documentary that's aired on the Seven Network and tells the stories of three colourful Australians who share one faith, but they each have very different stories and dark pasts. One of them is the former bikie chick, Susan Conroe, who had rebellious teenage years in a dysfunctional family. Then, the God Squad came to her rescue, and today she's a wife, a mum, with a very real, grounded Christian faith. Yet another great story of transformation and a great reminder of the power of God's love as we celebrate the sacrifice and resurrection of his son Jesus this Easter Sunday. Susan Conroe, welcome to Open House.
Hi there.
Really glad that you joined us. Thank you so much, Susan. Can you tell us how you got involved in this documentary called Forgiven People?
Well, I got invited by the producer to be involved, as it was a colourful story of, rising out of the ashes of abuse and a very topical culture, the bike culture, and experiencing things that, you know, require much forgiveness and understanding. And I used to work in a voluntary capacity with the producer in our early days because I had a 30-year welfare career helping disadvantaged youth with similar issues. And I used to cross paths with Vic in those days down when we had the groups running at the institution for girls and things like that.
Did it take you long to agree to be part of that documentary?
No,
and tell
not
your story?
At all. Yeah. Not at all. I love telling my story because it's a message of hope. It's a message of how possibilities to arise from complete dysfunction and family stuff that can put individuals behind in life and often keep them that way. But this is a story of hope that you can transcend those issues and almost use them to help people get through their own stuff.
Your story is featured along with two others, Jono and Monique, in this documentary. Susan, what are some of the common things that you guys share in very different stories?
The common story, as I can gather it, is that we all come from a systemic part of abuse to ourselves, whether that be inflicted on us by others, by sexual abuse, self-abuse, drug abuse, and they're all very different perspectives of how we experience those things and then as a result of faith rose out of it.
So take us through your story. You grew up, as I said, in this dysfunctional home. Is that where your troubles started?
Yes, most definitely, yes. I was a latchkey kid. We grew up in the inner suburbs of Melbourne. There was my brother and I, and my mother was quite a social butterfly and a very hard-working person in the fashion industry. We just left to our own devices, and that was fine. And then, you know, the wicked stepfather came home to live, and that was the beginning of the end of my comfortable childhood years. And I was sexually abused by him at 10, and then I developed an attitude. Didn't really share that with anybody, just developed an attitude of anger and inner conflict, if you like. I was quite the prodigy. I had good marks at school and good creative gifts with piano and music and all that sort of stuff. Then I went into the bike scene from about 12 years onwards. I was sort of running with the wolves, and we moved to the outer east of Melbourne and had a whole new network of friends and experiences.
12 years old is a very early start in that culture.
It is. It's like, you know, it's almost like it's somebody else's life when I reflect back now at the age of 55, you know, having had four children of my own ranging from 22 to 36. But when you think of a 12-year-old being with 19-year-olds and 21-year-olds, and then at 14, my was 14 and 15 was pivotal for me meeting God, because it was a real God moment that I experienced.
What drew you to the bikies in the first place at the age of 12, Susan?
Oh, we were just hanging around our local estate, and people, you know, someone would have a bike, and we thought, oh, let's start up our own bike group, and then we thought we were really cool, and used to go to Elizabeth Street in Melbourne where all the bikies would gather, and then someone would say, oh, there's a party on, and off we go. And I, you know, I'm a 6 foot tall girl, and, you know, I didn't look 12, you know. It was quite attractive and tall, and didn't look 12, looked 18. So, you know, I was like a child in a very young woman's body.
How much trouble did you and your biking mates get into at that time?
Well, you know, in those days it was all about rock and roll and good times and parties. But, you know, like anything in life, there's always, you know, good and bad. Probably more the violence. You know, in those days you could smack someone and get away with it. You can't do that really much anymore. But the old days of, you know, solving your own problems with violence are pretty much gone, you know.
How would you describe the bikie culture then and how it's changed to today? Because it is a very different beast now.
It is a very different culture. I mean, look, you know, the bikie culture is very attractive for dysfunctional family people, because it's like a brotherhood and a family outside of your own. And that was the attractive thing definitely for me, that you had a whole bunch of brothers and sisters and father figures and all that sort of stuff to, you know, offer that sense of belonging, which, you know, is what every human needs.
So lots of people look down their noses at bikies, but for someone at your stage and age, there were good things about it.
In those days, it was like a family. Yes, you had your shady characters that were quite violent or into, you know, raping and pillaging or stealing or, you know, all of those things that, you know, are current trends today. But it was a lighter side of group existence. And you know, today they are cleaning up their acts. And I've talked to a lot of the modern day bikies, and I like some of the concepts. The things haven't changed. It's just that the way that people make money and perhaps form attachments and their anti-system is quite interesting.
So while there were good things about it for you, I suspect it was still an empty life at so many levels for you at that age.
Yes. Well, it's fickle, it's temporary. It depends on your experience. You know, my experience was one of, I was pain-killing my family life. I was killing the pain and I was acting out my inner rage by being anti-system and, you know, anti-social as such, in an acceptable form. And the attraction is that, because you can get away with that anarchy in a group like that. You know, that's why groups and gangs and that are formed, because they're making a statement of strength in numbers and anti-system, which is bad in one way, but it's understandable if the system is, you know, abusive to them.
And you feel as though it's stacked against you?
Well, the system was in those days, because you told someone about what happened to you, nothing happened, it was all hush hush, and, you know, no one wanted to know about it. We were very big on denial in those days. If you said that you were being abused now, someone would probably listen and investigate it. But in those days it was very hush hush, so, you know, the system wasn't really, and the whole culture of that era wasn't working for the secrets to come out.
So what happened to you at the age of 14, Susan?
At the age of 14, I was in that bike culture very strongly, and we went to a big party in Melbourne, and there was every bike club that was ever in existence there, and one of the Hell's Angels at the time, but that's not as to put them down in any way. It's just that there is, in every group, there is someone that will take, you know, matters into their own hands. And this particular person, you know, and we're talking 40 years ago, he was renowned for pinpointing young women and raping them and beating them. And that's pretty much what happened. I could feel the eyes on me, and then I felt a bottle, and then I thought, I'm dead, I'm gone. And then, you know, I experienced a brutal rape and a beating. And you were on your own with that, because in that culture, everyone just turns their back, you know. And then what happened, and this is the God moment. The God moment was, I'm in this dilapidated farmhouse, and you know, I feel trapped, and I can't get out of what I'm going to experience and have experienced. And then I see, like very often in those days, and it probably still happens today, that, you know, that gang bang thing. And, you know, there were a long line of guys lined up at the door, and I remember thinking very strongly out the window, I said, please, God, no, I can't do that. You may as well kill me or save me. And, you know, I did this heartfelt prayer that came from my boots, please save me from this, I can't do that. There must have been 20 of them there. And I knew I wouldn't survive it. And I thought, please, I'll never put myself at risk again. I'll serve you to the day I die. Da, 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 da. And then, you know, as we know, miracles happen. And, you know, that heartfelt prayer was answered, and I was delivered out of that instantly. You know, and that perpetrator turned into quite a rescuing prince, and he took me to the door. I didn't escape what I had to with him, but, you know, he took me to the door and he said, if anybody touches this girl, I will kill them. And he said, walk free. It was a bit like Moses parting that Red Sea, you know, that's what it felt like. And I did, I walked free and I never looked back. But I remember the instant power of that prayer, and there were, you know, there were no two ways about it. It was do or die.
But it wasn't a cry to God and a prayer to God just for that night.
It was a commitment. It was a taking of full responsibility. I remember thinking I was taking full responsibility for the risk that I put myself into. And I wasn't asking anyone to save me from that particular moment, but I was asking for assistance for the next lot of moments and then life thereafter.
So how did that new and very fledgling faith in God play out for you from then, Susan?
Yeah, from then I met my husband, who was actually one of the founding members of the Hells Angels in Melbourne years ago, with his two friends that are now deceased. And he had a God experience, and he joined the God Squad. And I sort of slipped back a little bit into my, once I had a family and got married, and that I became a little bit cautious of the conventional God and church sort of gig. And I looked upon that very curiously, and then saw a great change in him and a dedication in life by the God Squad and that whole community, because that was a culture we were used to, the bike culture.
Yes.
But there was a chance to be part of a very new church and a growing community.
You must explain to us what the God Squad is, for those who don't know.
Yes, well, it is a Christian motorcycle club. The vision from John Smith, from my experience with them all those years, was to take that message of God and hope to the disadvantaged communities, especially the bike scene. So being out there and available to those bike culture people to have a chance to experience, you know, a God of hope.
It's interesting contrast in community from your early bikey days to a true community.
Yes.
With God at the centre.
Yes, well, the message back then was a belonging. You know, in the early days, coming out of family into a brotherhood, it's a sense of belonging, it's a sense of camaraderie and a sense of safety in numbers. But then that changes when you can become a member of God's family and you go into something like a growing church community. It becomes a message of love and family and all of those traditions that, you know, were void in my family life.
How do you look back on the experiences that I guess you would acknowledge God enabled you to go through? with what your life is like now?
Looking back, you know, it's a matter of having the skeleton in the closet and bringing that out, which, you know, was a very handy thing to have in my toolbox as a welfare worker.
Yes.
Because all those kids that had been sexually abused and beaten and raped, and there was an IV drug stage for a year that I was pain killing in those early years, and I, as a result, got hepatitis, and I now have that chronic liver disease, which is a bit debilitating. But, you know, a healthy lifestyle and a good attitude is handling that. But what it was I had a wealth of experience of tragedy and personal loss and abuse, really, to share with those kids. And, you know, as a worker, I had the professional training, but I also knew the pain in their hearts, and I was often sitting in the gutter talking to them about the messages of hope and my own experiences, and was very well known but careful in that industry to give the message of Jesus. And I was always known for that spiritual element. And unfortunately, when you work for a non-church organisation, you have to be diplomatic with your faith. So you become more of a living example rather than, you know, someone that has to preach that message.
Yes, but it's very real, though.
Yeah, it is very real. That is a transformation that cannot be denied, which almost words are not actually necessary, because once you declare your experience of, you know, whether it be rape, pillage, drug abuse or sexual abuse, which, you know, for me, I mean, as regards to the other two profilees in the doco, I experienced all of those things. My archetype is the ex-bikey chick, but I experienced drug abuse and sexual abuse and, you know, the bike culture in its positive and negative aspects. Very interesting toolbox to share with very tragic young people looking for hope in life.
I'm sure it's a great gift for them. Susan, what's the future look like for you?
The future for me is now I retired, and it was a little bit an enforced retirement because where I live, we went through Black Saturday and there was quite some tragic experiences with that. So I got a little dose of post-traumatic stress disorder, which I now handle very well. But I've turned my Christian sharing gifts into an encourager. So I'm now a voluntary person that's retired, and anyone in need that's got a broken heart or struggling with issues in life, I'll get alongside of them if they cross my path and lead them through to hope.
I'm sure you're a gift for them too.
It's a free gift. That's the advantage. You don't have to wait in line for it or put your name on a waiting list. It's all there, ready. For me, the future looks like basking in the sunshine and the glory of my faith, you know, and I'm very excited about sharing that faith with my friends and family, and some very eagerly fellowshipping and some not. But, you know, I am an example of change, and that's what I choose to do, be an example of change, serve God, and be guided by Him as to where I am led in life. And I live quite a sedate life in the country, and I have lots of friends and people that need help around me, and that's how I see myself, as an encourager in life.
I'm so glad you have shared your story with us this Easter Sunday night. Susan Conroe, thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.